who prompted today's sermon not only gave me a topic and said, here, Bart, preach on this, but she also gave me three Bible verses to go along with the topic, so she just volleyed it up for me. And the topic today is the topic of idolatry. And as a person pointed out, this is still a big one today. And the three verses come from Exodus, from Jeremiah, and from Matthew. Let's listen for a living word. It says, When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandment tablets, then God spoke all of these words, beginning with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You must have no other gods before me. And later, the prophet Jeremiah sent a letter from Jerusalem to the surviving elders of the Judean exiles, to the priests and to the prophets and to all the people that the emperor had taken to Babylon from Jerusalem, saying, the Lord of heavenly forces, the God of Israel, proclaims to all the exiles I have carried off from Jerusalem to Babylon, when you search for me, yes, search for me with all your heart, you will find me. And when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had left the Sadducees speechless, as he so often did, one of them tested him. Teacher, he said, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And you know it well. Jesus replied, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, and with all your mind. This is holy wisdom, holy word. Thanks be to God. And in the spirit of summer, Audrey is going to share her own reflection on the text with us.
Well, actually, a couple weeks ago, I asked Bart what the lectionary was going to be so I could prepare and reflect on it early. He said, I don't have a lectionary, but I have a word for it. And he said, of course, the word was idols. So what image comes to your mind when you hear the word idols? For me, it was, to be honest, it was the movie of the Ten Commandments. I could picture all the Israelites collecting the gold and baking the golden calf, and then God being very angry. And the Israelites wanted something tangible to that they could see and touch that would lead and protect them. They have lost their faith in Moses and in God. But God decides not to destroy them, but Moses then orders the people of the Levi tribe to kill like thousands of their relatives because they had disobeyed God, and they did it. Bart had said about the Ten Commandments, about that you shall have no other gods before me and you shall not make idols. But I know that idols are not just from times long ago. An idol can be a person or a thing that is greatly admired, revered, or loved. If a being from another universe came to visit and tried to identify what we admired, loved, or revered, would he say it would be God? Would it be our cell phones? Our cars, our families, our flag, our pursuit of money, power, or comfort. If we look at the world today, you might think that God has been very angry, just by all the stuff that's been happening. I came across this quote, an author unknown, on Facebook, which we probably considered another kind of idol. People were created to be loved. Things were created to be used. The reason why the world is in chaos is because things are being loved and people are being used. Have we lost our faith in God and put this faith instead in idols? How can we show that we admire, love, and revere God? What does it really look like? In 1 John chapter 4:20, it says, but if we say we love God and don't love each other, we are liars. We cannot see God. So how can we love God if we don't love the people?
The first thing that comes to mind when I hear the word idols, I wish was a Bible story, but it's not. It's a scene from the movie Major League. Anyone seen that movie? Major League's great. It was in 1989, starring Charlie Sheen, and it's about the Cleveland Indians baseball club, whose new owner tries to tank the team by recruiting the very worst players in professional baseball. And she wants to move the franchise to the sunnier Miami from Cleveland, so she fills the roster with these motley crew of characters. And one scene begins in the locker room when the right fielder, Pedro, who's from the Caribbean, is praying in Spanish right in front of his locker to this voodoo statue. And some of the other players start to gather around and wonder what he's doing. And he's starting to light a cigar in the mouth of this wiry-haired, wild-looking statue. So they ask him, "Pedro, what are you doing?" And Pedro replies, "The bats, they are sick. I cannot hit curveball. Straight ball, I hit very much. Curveball, bats are afraid. I ask Jabu, the statue's name, to come take away fear from bats. I offer him cigar and rum." And one of the pitchers, an older man with a country accent, Eddie, scoffs at the ritual when he says smugly, in that way that people do, "You know, you might consider taking Jesus Christ as your savior instead of fooling with all this nonsense." And Pedro replies, "Ah, Jesus, I like him very much, but he's no help with curveball." And the guy replies, "Are you telling me that Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?" That's what I think about when I hear of idols. But, as Audrey said, it's an old idea with new implications. And I'm willing to bet that most Americans, American Christians, and definitely most Presbyterians aren't in the habit of offering sacrifices to idols. We're traditionally not the ritualistic type. So, you know, when Moses adds that commandment, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth below, or that is in the water under the earth," that doesn't really apply to us at first glance. But make no mistake, we all have our idols. Our disordered loves. Our inordinate attachments. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said that there are more idols than there are realities. And John Calvin, the founder of our Reformed wing of Christianity, the branch of our family, wrote that the human heart is an idol factory. Yeah, I just quoted Calvin. Mark your calendars. But he actually, in his magnum opus, the Institutes of the Christian Religion, actually devoted two chapters to this subject. Because Calvin was generally opposed to worship with images and candles and crucifixes and statues and so forth that were a part of medieval Catholicism, because he believed it was superstitious. But more importantly for Calvin, God was so sovereign. God was so beyond containable. And there was no need for images because the image of God was stamped in one place, and that is on human beings. But I think what he meant when he called the human heart an idol factory is that we as people are always looking for something to worship. We're always in search of something to attach our ultimate allegiance, whether we know it or not. And because we're human, We latch on to things tightly. We latch on to things and people and ideas for our ultimate satisfaction or security. Frederick Buechner defined idolatry as this: the practice of ascribing absolute value to things of relative worth. And he said that under certain circumstances, it sounds a lot like Audrey's list, money, patriotism, sexual freedom, moral principles, family loyalty, physical health, social or intellectual preeminence, and so on, are fun things to have around, but to make them the standard by which all other values are measured, to make them your masters, to look to them to justify your life and save your soul is sheerest folly, because they just aren't up to it. In other words, I think what he's saying is we try to substitute cheap alternatives for the real thing. And there are some prime candidates for idols today. Career. Ooh. Self-sufficiency. You know, that whole bootstraps thing. Convenience. Power. Dare I say, political ideology. Can you think of any others?
Nationalism.
Getting there. Hold on. 4 minutes. I mean, you think about all these different idols. What of our personal well-being and what of our common wholeness is sacrificed on the altars of these idols? I mean, there's money, of course. Money is kind of the easy pick. How much is enough for those of us in this culture? How does that kind of worship via overconsumption impact us, our families, the planet? How much confidence do we place in wealth for our future? I'm kind of indicted by that. I check my Roth IRA balance probably on at least a weekly basis, which is weird for someone in his early 30s, but, you know, profit and money, I think, has reached the status of deity. Our political leaders, particularly in Arizona, seem bent on privatizing more prisons, healthcare, and now even education. And it makes you wonder, where do people believe that image of God resides? Is it here or in the bottom line? There's a book by Scott Gustafson entitled The Altar of Wall Street, The Rituals, Myths, Theologies, Sacraments, and Mission of the Religion Known as the Modern Global Economy. I haven't read it, but the premise is that economics functions in our current global culture as religions have in society's past. Money, if you think about it, is a kind of sacrament, which makes sense. And the economy has its liturgies. It has these forms of worship that shape our character. They shape our habits. That's not the only one. In all seriousness, as someone from the South, I can tell you football is a religion. It has its rituals. It has its ultimate allegiance. It demands something of crowds. And as Janet mentioned, on this holiday weekend, it bears pointing out that nationalism is an idolatry. It's an old one, but it's alive and well. One nation under God sometimes morphs into one God under nation, right? And this idolatry spawns senseless wars and oppressive immigration policies and globalization, all those other things. But the good news, or well, not there yet, but the overarching message of Scripture is that these loves that we have, these attachments, are out of alignment. And we cause ourselves and others a lot of grief because of that. And God's invitation in faith is to give God our ultimate allegiance, which then realigns our loves in a healthy way. As that verse from Jeremiah read, when you search for me with all your heart, you'll find me. Or as Jesus put it, love God with all your heart and all your being and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Faith, or I like to say trust, it takes us out of ourselves and it recalibrates that ego, and it at least attempts to find a balance between God and neighbor and self. But when we put that faith, when we put that ultimate trust into something lesser, some lesser than God, we suffer and others suffer. Maybe another way to think about idolatry is to rank our loves. What do we care about the most? honestly, what's the most important to us? In what or whom do we place our ultimate confidence? And how are these truths evident in our lives and how we spend our time and energy and resources? I'll close with a story that the author and the priest Henry Nouwen tells in one of his books. It's an ancient tale from India. It says that four royal sons were questioning what specialty they should master. And they said to one another, "Let's search the earth and let's learn a special science." So they decided, and after a while they agreed on a place where they'd reconvene, and the four brothers scattered off, each in a different direction. And time went by, and the brothers met again at this appointed meeting place, and they asked one another what they had learned. "I have mastered a science," said the first, "which makes it possible for me, if I have nothing but a piece of bone of some creature, to create the flesh that goes along with it." "I," said the second, "know how to grow that creature's skin and hair if there is flesh on the bones." The third said, "I am able to create limbs if I have the flesh, the skin, and the hair." And I, concluded the fourth, "know how to give life to a creature if its form is complete with limbs." So the four brothers went into the jungle to find a piece of bone that they could demonstrate their specialty and their skill. And as fate would have it, the bone they found was a lion's. And one brother added flesh to the bone, the second grew hair and skin, and the third completed it with limbs, and the fourth gave the lion life. And shaking its heavy mane, the ferocious beast arose with a menacing mouth, sharp teeth, and merciless claws, and you can probably guess what happened. The idols of our own creation can consume us and others if we let them. May it not be so.